Hey, welcome to Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. I'm Kuma, and I talk a lot about trains. Well, one thing that virtually every train, there's always an exception, but virtually all trains have one thing in common, they run on wheels. Like almost every other land vehicle, wheels have been the way to move land vehicles. I mean, you know, I don't have to go back to chariots. I can go back to carts, wheelbarrows, and other things that date back millennia. So the wheel is, who invented that one? You find somebody else. I'm not going to go there. Anyway, in the earliest days of rail operations, and by that I'm going to go back to the 13th, 14th, 15th century. It doesn't matter where. We're talking about the little small mine carts. Like the ones, if I'm not around, please somebody post a picture from the Kuma's photo gallery of the funny little wooden ore car with the really odd curved wheels. They're wooden wheels. The wheels were flanged to fit over the rails, which are wood. So wood was the basis to make everything out of for a long time. And when the very first railways, and we'll jump up to the 19th century, well, wood was still used for a lot of things. Now, by that point, almost all wooden wheels for, and by the way, the first locomotives had wooden wheels. The wheel was made out of wood. It had a iron tire around that. Now, it's interesting to note that many, many stagecoaches and other wagons of the Old West that in the United States and across parts of Europe also had wooden wheels. You know, a horse-drawn thing would have a wooden wheel, but it would have this thin sliver of iron run around it because it wore better. It wouldn't wear out so fast, so that was helpful. Now, on the just as a sidestep, some of the earliest rails were all wood and had a small strip of iron on top of them to as the wear surface. So again, metal was clearly better for the wear surface, the tire or the top of the rail. So the cone-shaped wheel, like we saw on that one, well, sort of double cones to hold it on, that was common up to the 19th century, probably not even all through the 18th, that people said, that's kind of lame. And better flanged wheels could be made, which were lighter, easier to use, and easier to push. Oh, we're trying to make it easier on people. No. Now remember, it was never to make it easier for the worker. It was meant that the worker could do the same work and move more stuff. That's always there. All right. Now, by the early parts of the 19th century, and especially after, you might say, the introduction period, you know, 1803 when we had Richard Trevithick's first locomotives through what we talked about with Matthew Murray's locomotives to the early George Stephenson ones in the 1820s and 1830s. All the wheels then were, how do I say, very carefully made. Most of them, again, were mostly wood. The wheels were mostly wood with this iron tire. Well, once we get up to about, I'm not going to pin dates down, but around 1834, wrought iron wheels were being made for locomotives. They needed to be more than wood because the weight of these locomotives was 4 tons, 6 tons, 10 tons. Yes, a 10-ton locomotive started to show up by the middle of the 1830s. So you had to have something stronger for that. So wrought iron wheels for the locomotive drivers, the main those were come up with. Well, through the 1840s, we now have cast iron wheels. Now, cast iron are much stronger than wrought iron, but here's one little problem with cast iron. Cast iron is somewhat brittle. It can crack easily. It's stronger. You have to understand that there's a problem between strength and brittleness. You can be both strong and brittle. I mean, look at an eggshell. An eggshell is actually very strong, but is also very brittle. So, anyway, now, you also had another factor that started coming up, and that was that the size of wheels started to get bigger. Now, why was that? Well, it turned out that a bigger wheel, and you might have seen this because they were actually matching road, you know, carriages, wagons, whatever, practices. It was learned very early that a bigger wheel was A, easier to push, and second, it tended to last longer. Oh, does anyone hear the old train in the background? I'm leaving it in. I like my sound effects of trains going by. It makes me feel railroady. Anyway, so again, wheel sizes came up. And it's funny because later they got back smaller. But for a long time, railway wheels got much bigger, much larger in diameter. Now, here's another thing. And I wished I had Publius because he could explain the chemistry and the physics of this far better than I can. And if he ever wants to, let him, please. But there is the problem between wrought iron and cast iron. Cast iron, as I say, has some problems with its being... Wrought iron is actually, being wrought, I mean, you can actually bend the stuff. That's a problem. But it also means it's not tends to fracture. It'll give. But you don't really want it to give. You want it to be stronger, so they went to cast iron. Well, here's one really super neat trick of cast iron. And this is why they sometimes, and I'll talk about this as I go on, of making the tires, the outer tires, in this manner. There'd be cast iron. And what you'd do is you'd make them a little bigger or just a little smaller than what you wanted. You'd heat them up, they'd expand, you'd drop them onto the wheel, and then cool it down very rapidly, and they'd stick on. It's great. They do that. They did that all the way through most of the 20th, or big chunks of the 20th century, all through a lot of the half of the 19th. So we're talking 100 years this was a common practice. And it was a common practice just to, you know, snake the wheels down for your, a blacksmith in a small town in the west, or in the east even, was doing this on a daily basis to fix a wagon wheel, because the wheel was made out of wood, but you wanted to fit this tire on nice and tight. Well, here's another trick. You can do that. It's an easy trick to get the iron, you know, to shrink down just a little bit after you cooled it, to get it to fit. Great. But here's another trick that you can do with cast iron wheels. Okay, this is a tricky thing to do, but it's a really neat thing to do. It's called chilling. Okay, what the hell's chilling? I'm fuzzy myself on the exact process, but it's a form of cooling the iron very quickly, very quickly. And the area of chilling, where it's the highest cold difference in it, can cause the iron to, at the molecular point, rearrange a little bit, and it becomes super hard. I mean, really hard. You know, not quite diamond hard, but in that sort of direction. Well, what's the big deal? A hard surface wears longer. It doesn't wear out. It's very good at not wearing. It's unfortunately, it tends to be a lot more tend to fracturing, but if only the little surface, the less than a millimeter thick area is chilled, that takes all the wear. Okay. And if you're doing it on tires, well, this is even better because you can replace it. Now, some companies were making fully cast iron wheels that had been chilled. The problem was, once the wheel got damaged in any way, you had to throw the whole thing out and start over. And that, having to start all over, irritates railroads to no end. So, anyhow. Now, I was looking here at a man, one of my things, a man named Davis, who had, from 1834 to 1847, had a special patent on wheel construction. And what it was he had worked out a method of putting in strengthening rods inside of his forms so that when it went, you know, and then we were pouring the, or making the cast iron, it already had these rods in it, which made it much stronger. Now, then you could chill the outer edge, and presto, you had a strong wheel. And this went on from 1834 to 1847, though at some point he sold it off to a guy named Williams. But he had a patent, and boy, he made some money off that little sucker. Well, let's keep going there. Now, as I said, they had gone from wood to metal, especially for locomotive main drivers, because of the strength problem. Well, here's the thing. By the 1850s, many manufacturers went back to spoked wheels for all types of railway wheels. Why? Well, with the metal, you could get away with it. And the second is, the less the wheel weighed, the better. You have to remember something, and I'll go into this many other times. There's something called unsprung weight. That's the weight on the rails that's not sprung. I mean, everything above the axle usually has springs or anything to absorb shock. And that's good. It reduces the wear and tear of the whole train car, locomotive, passenger car, freight car, whatever. But here's the little problem. The more the wheel weighs, the more that's not sprung, and it just tends to... Here's the funny thing. This is going to thing. It's hard to remember this. Trains run on tracks. The train eats up the track. It ruins the track. It breaks the track. What? Trains are no different than your car and potholes. There is no difference, or cracks in the road, cracks in the rail, cracks, pits in the road, pits in the rail, a weak area under the road, and the whole road sinks a little bit. That happens to railroads. And you don't want those problems. So anything you can do to reduce that problem, oh boy, you want to do that. So reducing the weight of the wheel, but making it simply as strong, that was a big seller for spoked wheels. It had a lot of problems because, if you ever go and look at the Big Boy or one of the other steam engines at some park or museum, you look at that wheel very carefully. There's a spot where the crank, the connecting rod, connects to the wheel, which picks, in a sense, transmits the power to the wheel. But if you look around the wheel, you maybe find another spot with a big lump of metal. That's because the wheel had to be balanced. The same as car tires are balanced with little lead weights. They had to balance these wheels because you don't want them being off concentrically. Tear the tracks to pieces. So there was some difficulties with that. Well, another thing came along which was, again, similar to the tire trick, and that was the two-part wheel. In other words, the part that was the shell part with the where you would chill it and everything else, and the other part was slightly, I'm not going to go into the metallurgy, it was slightly wrought, slightly cast, it was more of wrought iron, which was the inside section, so that you would have something with a little bit of give, and then the two sections were fused together. That was a two-part wheel. They even tried three-part and four-part wheels. So that was not worth the bother. Sometimes you can take a process and take it too far. Well, I've gone over chilling. That's an important part because that was a great way to reduce wear. But, oopsie, chilling had another problem. It had another problem. Well, they had another problem with the whole wheel. Now, as I said on another time, and I will come back to this over and over and over again. In the early days of railroading, the brakes for slowing down the train were pitiful. That's the only word for it, pitiful. I mean, matter of fact, some of the shoes contacting the wheel were made of wood. Yes, wood. Maybe a very hard wood like oak or something, but it was wood. And if it started to heat up, guess what? The wood would burn, or at least char off. So that wasn't a problem. Well, by the middle of the 19th century, and maybe a little before, 1840, 1850, that was not good enough. We needed something with more. And so metal shoes started showing up. Well, once you had powered wheels, i.e., by the late 1850s, early 1860s, when we started to have air brakes, or even just on the locomotive, even on just the locomotive with a steam brake, there was a real problem that these brake shoes could press hard enough on the wheels to start raising the temperature of the wheel to the point of where it might fail. I'm not kidding, that was a real problem, and it was even worse, in a sense, in the railroads that were in winter or cold conditions. I'm thinking of the Pennsylvania, the New York Central, the B&O, way up in the north in the winter, where, you know, the outside temperature is clearly below the freezing point of water, and it's cold, and so sitting around or just running down the rails, the wheels are relatively cold, and suddenly you kind of stop, and this iron shoe comes in, and the train stops. Well, now the wheels are quite warm, and then you take off and start going, and now you've cooled them again, and then you hit the brakes again, and this extreme temperature changes, yeah, that caused a lot of wheel failures, and many railroads finally said, okay, if we can't find better brakes, run the train slower. And they did. They actually had, some of the railroads had winter speeds. They had to go much slower in the winter to avoid the extreme temperature change. Now I'm going to come to another funny one. Now, we're talking, I'm going to get to other materials some other day, but right now, we're still talking about iron wheels. Well, they had a problem with iron wheels failing, and they needed to test them. Well, this is 1850, 1860. I know, we'll use a computer-controlled x-ray machine. Oh, we don't have those. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? We could cut the wheel. Oh, well, if we cut the wheel, it's no longer any good. Oh, what? We came up with a bright idea. To test wheels, this is in the factory, at the factory level, and they actually set this up as a semi-standard test, and I can go into the specifications of it. I'm not going to. But the point was they got this really big hammer. I mean, literally a drop hammer. You'd crank it up, you know, and then let it go. Bang! Okay. And what you do is you drop this drop hammer on these wheels. And the wheel went ding, ding, ding each time and got hit several times. They'd say, okay, that's a good tire. That's a good wheel. It's strong. And they'd put it into service. Well, one manufacturer, I'm not going to say which one, but one manufacturer, they brought their wheel in, put it under the hammer, and it almost cracked in several places. They dropped the hammer a second time, and it shattered. And they say, that's a lousy wheel. That's a really and they tested several others and found that their manufacturing process sucked. Okay? That's a technical term. It stank. It was awful. And that particular company couldn't sell wheels to anybody but things that weren't moving. Because there was just no... Now, another funny bit was all through this period, up to and into the 20th century, one of the ways of testing the wheels on a railway car, I'm saying, you know, this string of railway cars come in, and you want to test the wheels. Well, somebody would walk by with a very heavy hammer, metal hammer, and they'd go, bang, on the thing, and it'd go, ding, you know, and it would make the ring noise, and they'd say, okay, that's a good tire, and they'd go, bing, and the guy would just go along and tapping tire, and if the tire went, oh, that's a bad one, we should replace that, and they would test tires railway wheels with a hammer for years. You could tell a lot by the sound of a, if there were too many cracks or pockets inside the tire, it changed the sound. And so, okay, that's a bad one. It didn't have to have the exact same tone. You know, one wheel could be, doom, and then one could be, ooh, another one could go, ooh, you know, it could be a nice, it's slightly, you know, like the different bells on a xylophone. But as long as it was a pure tone, okay, that's fine. All right. So that's a bit about railway wheels. Now, I want to go off here. I have about 8-9 minutes here. I want to go off and talk about one other kind of railway wheel that is so, well, silly, odd, strange, unbelievable. Okay, let's go. Let's jump to 1869. We're past the American Civil War, and American inventors are really good at coming up with crazy ideas. So we go, and I'm not making this up. This is a fact. This is a fact. The Allen Paper Car Wheel Company. Kuma, are you out of your gourd? No, this was a company that made paper wheels. Now, let me explain. These were, in a sense, three parts. There is a thing that looks sort of like a bowl or dish. It's the part of the wheel that has the notch in it, the flange. Okay, just the flange. Nothing beyond the flange. Nothing. Just, and the big open area in the middle, which supports all the weight. And what they did was, they filled that entire center area with this pre-made paper wheel. In other words, the bulk of the wheel structure was made out of paper. They took a certain kind of paper, put it in this humongous multi-hundred ton press until it was fused into this one big hunk of paper. And they drilled some holes in it, one for the, you know, for the axle to go through, and some other holes, and they put it into this metal insert, and then they put a backing on it, put some bolts through it, and tightened it up and said, there you go, you got a paper wheel. Well, the point was the paper was much lighter than the steel, so we had lower unsprung weight. Well, initially this seemed like a great idea. Even the famous Pullman company had some of their Pullman sleeping cars on paper wheels. The paper having a little teeny tiny, I mean molecular amounts, but about a give, would absorb much of the vibration, and they ran quiet. Wait a minute. Here's two problems. One, it's bolted together. After a while, those bolts started to come undone, no matter what they did. And second, there was the other problem of heating. The brake shoe would come in, hit the outer wheel, and it would eventually warm up the paper. Well, the paper was sealed. It wasn't catching fire or anything, but it was changing it in ways, and it became less strong, and many a paper wheel failed. Now, why in the devil did anybody ever think of paper? Well, it was there. It could make work. And do remember, here's a side point. Jules Verne's famous story, Master of the World, has a flying machine called the Albatross. Made it into a pretty fair movie. And Albatross was made of paper to make it light enough, because it was not an airship. It was more of a helicopter. Very weird. Anyway, so people had this idea about paper. See, that's where you have to be careful about sci-fi stories. Somebody comes up and says, well, that's a great idea. No, it's a stupid idea. It just works in a book because nobody has to actually build it. So the Allen Paper Car Wheel Company, no, we're starting 1869, it was in business for some time. But by the mid-1870s, there were a number of paper wheels that failed. Now, the company came out and blamed people for not maintaining them properly, for putting them under too much weight from what they were spec'd for. Just like any modern company, immediately blame people, you know, Your car ran into a wall. You shouldn't have been driving it at all. You know, like, oh, yes, right. I got a car because I'm not going to drive it. This is a major problem. And it took a while until, roughly the early part of the 20th century. These were still in service. And by the way, these were mostly used on passenger cars and were very popular on street railways. Again, as I said, that unsprung weight. Now, they worked very well on street railways because, well, street cars didn't tend to go very fast and didn't have much of the heating problem. So they were very popular. And it's one of the reasons the company lasted so long is because that was one niche where they seemed to work pretty good. But by 1915, they were declared unsafe. You know, no less than the Interstate Commerce Commission said, those things are terrible. And so, oddly enough, the Allen plant took many, many years to actually disappear because they were still servicing and repairing ones that they already had made. So it was about 8 years after that or so that that went away. And by the time that happened, say 1920, if you told somebody, even a railroad who had used them, that there were paper wheels, they would tend to look at you like, oh gosh, that's got to be a silly myth. Nobody would ever be so stupid as to make wheels out of paper. And even today, you know, reading some of the books and articles, I still have a hard time believing myself that this was done. So you might think of it as the composite material of today. Oh, by the way, before I forget it, another company in the early 1870s thought, hey, we got to get in on this. So another company, are you ready? Instead of paper, they tried hemp. They had the hemp car wheel company. I can't even say it without snickering. Yes, they were making railway wheels out of hemp. That didn't fly nearly as good as paper wheels did. So anyway, that's what we have for now. And we will come back some other day and talk about more other things about railway wheels, like flanges and wheel profiles and sizes and all sorts of stuff about railway wheels, because that's what trains run on wheels. Anyway, that's all for right now. Hope you've learned a little about railway wheels, where they came from, why they're round. Anyway, I hope to see you on the train. Bye-bye.